From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so pleased that you took the time to download us and are listening. We're back from our summer vacation and all the construction that was going on here at the Huffines Institute, and we're so glad that you all are back as well, and we hope you had a great summer vacation and traveled well. We have a special podcast to kick off our fall series here starting. This is August 2nd. And our podcast today is with noted writer Dave Epstein from Sports Illustrated. Welcome back to the podcast, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. I think you're our all-time most podcasted guest. I think this is your fifth podcast with us.
Is it my fifth? All I know is that I think it'll be easier than what I remember as my last one, which was standing outside of a stadium in Qatar on a cell phone. Or at least that was one of the last few, so this should be easier.
Yeah, there you go. I think you fully represent about 4% of all of our podcasts, so welcome.
Right.
Welcome back. I want to tell the audience a little bit about, number one, if they haven't heard your podcast before, don't know anything about you, I want to tell them a little bit about you and then tell everybody why you're here, which is really a special occasion. As I said, Dave is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He has co-authored many of the Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com's highest-profile sports medicine pieces and sports medicine investigative pieces, including many of the doping articles that have come out over the last 5 or 6 years. He has been awarded many awards in the field of journalism. He was given the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Association's Big Hearted Journalist Award. He was given Time Incorporated's Henry Luce Award for public service for his articles on the dangers of the dietary supplement industry. He was given the Society of Professional Journalists 2010 Deadline Club Award for an article on the genetics of sports performance, which we're going to talk about today. And most recently, which was really cool, he was a finalist for the 2011 Livingston Award, which recognizes the best American journalist under the age of 35 years of age. And that was huge. That was a huge. And congratulations again on that finalist award there.
Thank you. This makes me sound much more distinguished than you know I really am. Thank you.
We're going to just jump into this. One of the reasons that we're here talking on August 2nd is that yesterday, on August 1st, your first book, The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance, became available. And it was based on that 2010 article in Sports Illustrated.
That's right. That sort of became the seed of it in many ways. And I would say, I wouldn't use the word based on it, just because I found my mind changed about certain things, and certain science changed between then. I mean, that article was written in mid 2010, and I got the contract in the summer of 2010. Mm. So it's been sort of 3 years in the process, and I learned a lot since then. That was certainly the seed, of the idea to sort of explore the genetics of athleticism, to take on the 10,000 hours rule and that sort of thing. But really the project ended up expanding in ways that I had not envisioned at all when I wrote that article.
Let's back up a little bit and tell us why you got interested in researching about the genetics of sport, because your background education and some of your earlier writing before SI was kind of in environmental science and astronomy, and you have publications in those kinds of areas. And so the segue into sports and writing for Sports Illustrated and now talking about exercise genetics, that's kind of an interesting segue. How did all that happen?
Well, so I was also an overnight crime reporter for New York Tabloid.
Oh, yes, that we can't forget that one.
But so I always thought I would write, but I thought I was going to be a scientist who writes, and I was a geology grad student in my previous life. One of the things that sort of pushed me towards sports science writing was partly just my own interest in reading about training physiology when I was an 800-meter runner in college. Mm-hmm. But also I had a good friend and training partner, a young man, first-generation immigrant from Jamaica, who was a state champion who I trained with in high school, who dropped dead after a mile race.
Oh. Wow.
And I got really interested in sudden death in athletes. And as I sort of, I had his family sign away, and this is, I write about this in one of the chapters in the book. I had his family sign away the rights to his medical records to me, and I went and gathered them up and tried to figure out what had happened, because everybody was just saying, you know, oh, heart attack, heart attack. And I realized that heart attack doesn't mean anything to me, mm-hmm. other than that someone's heart stops. You know, it doesn't really have any informational value.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of exploring that, and it turned out that he had this genetic disease, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and I got really interested in that and said, hey, look, I want to combine my passions for writing for sports and for science all in one, and to do something that'll make me feel a little less like my friend died in vain here. And in retrospect, I feel, you know, he did die in vain anyway, but hopefully at least we can make a teachable moment out of it.
Now, that episode, that was the basis or the seed, we'll use that terminology for that, the article Following the Trail of Broken Hearts that you won the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Association's award for. Is that correct?
That's correct. So that article it only briefly mentions my friend. It's more about another young man and some other cases, but that was certainly the inspiration. I mean, what happened was I had been pitching on sudden cardiac death in athletes to Sports Illustrated 2 years before I ever got my foot in the door.
Mm.
And they liked what I had to write, but they don't really take unsolicited freelance. So I sort of kept in touch with them as I built journalism experience, because I was you know, dropping out of my science program, and or finishing my science program. And I kept pitching it when I was in. They brought me in as a temp for somebody who went on maternity leave, and I kept pitching it, and they sort of said no. They didn't really know who I was. They didn't trust me that much, but I was in the building as a temp fact checker. And then, you know, one of the top marathoners in America dropped dead in the Olympic marathon trial,
mm-hmm.
for the 2008 Olympics, like five blocks away from our office.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how proximity, you know, even for a national publication, has a big effect on what editors decide to do. So all of a sudden they came and said, hey, you still have that stuff about sudden death in athletes? And so, you know, we were able to put that out in the very next issue, and that was really my first big sports science story, and the first thing that helped me get a foothold in Sports Illustrated.
So how did that vault into looking at the genetics of exercise?
Well, so the disease that my friend Kevin had, and it's the most common disease that causes sudden cardiac death in athletes, and actually it's the leading cause of sudden natural death in all Americans under 35, it is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM. And it's a disease that follows an autosomal dominant inheritance pattern, you know, so it's a coin flip chance of getting it. It's a single nucleotide polymorphism that causes it, usually on, actually now over 1,400 mutations, any one of which can cause it.
Wow.
Mostly in genes associated with, you know, that build heart muscle, some that regulate heart contraction. And I got really interested. That just got me interested in genetics and learning about genetics, but really some of the fundamental questions. And so I address HCM in a chapter called The Heartbreak Gene, which is chapter 15 of the book. But, you know, some of the fundamental questions about athleticism, I think, just came out of my own experience. So track was a popular sport at my high school because we had a mini Jamaican diaspora to Evanston, Illinois in the 1980s. So all the guys my age, there were a lot of Jamaicans in school, so we had this great track team. And I was sort of curious, you know, some of these guys were so fast, and I was sort of curious if they had, like, imported some speed gene from Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to college, and I'm running against East Africans, you know, this profusion of East Africans, and I'm saying, what's the deal? Like, how can there be so many that are this good? And so I started wondering, and I noticed in my own training group, we'd come into the season, everyone having done the same light training, and I'd train with a group of about eight guys. We would do the exact same workouts, stride for stride, every day, and we would never finish the race next to each other.
Wow.
We do the same training, but we become different runners. And I sort of started to ask myself, you know, what are the sources of these sort of talent hotbeds of athleticism, and what are the sources of this individualized sort of response to training? Does this have anything to do with genetics? So in many ways, this book was just a chance for me on somebody else's dime to say, what are the greatest questions I have about sort of the big nature versus nurture questions of athleticism, and how can I go about best answering them with the available science and also whatever anecdotes I can bring to bear.
Yeah, and we'll come back to the nature versus training aspect. We don't want to give too much away about the book, but just say a word to our listeners about the readability of this book. I mean, I can speak to that because I've seen an early press release of that or early copy of that. But, you know, so oftentimes in today's society, you say the word genetics and people's eyes either glaze over or they turn away and walk away really quickly, especially when it comes to popular science reading. How do we encourage people to read this book, to make them understand that this is a book that they need to read to understand some of the things that are going on right now in sports medicine?
Well, I'm at base, speaking of the readability, I'm at base a narrative writer, right? So this book opens with Jenny Finch, the great softball pitcher, striking out major league hitters. Mm. You know, it doesn't open with a scene in a lab. That said, I find some of the sort of scientific detective stories to be fascinating. So in the book, I tried to, and I find scientists to be really fascinating people, and what they do to be a really special kind of detective work. So, you know, I have lots of elite athletes. I mean, I did hundreds of interviews. Many are with Olympic and world champions, some with people, you know, who have sort of very rare physical traits or gene mutations. So people can expect lots of interviews from elite athletes. At the same time, when I did write about scientists, or when I did have scenes in the lab, I tried to sort of unfurl that in the way that I view scientists, which is as a sort of, you know, like detectives,
right?
And to sort of show a little bit of that process. And I'm a narrative writer, and I will say the original article that appeared in Sports Illustrated, I think is much more dry and less narrative than this book.
Mm.
And if the article was able to appear in Sports Illustrated, you know, my editors must have felt it had some popular appeal, and I think the book is much more narrative than the article was. So I think it's an easier read than the article that was in SI.
Now, speaking of that, people can actually pick up this week's SI and see an excerpt from your book, right?
That's correct. It's an excerpt from that very first chapter I just mentioned with Jenny Finch striking out major leaguers. And you get to see, you know, Barry Bonds and Alex Rodriguez sort of behaving as they always do in that, so that's always fun.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, you know, you said you interviewed hundreds of folks for this and did quite a bit of traveling. I know you traveled to Africa, and at least once you went to the Arctic Circle, didn't you?
That's right. Actually, I went to the Arctic Circle twice. So as I tell people in my one sentence is, I reported from below the equator and above the Arctic Circle. So one of my trips above the Arctic Circle, when I had to cut back my word length for publishing, with one stroke of the delete key, I said, well, there goes a trip to Sweden. But I guess that's just how it works, you know. But yeah, I did, both places. So and I'd never been below the equator before. I had been above the Arctic Circle because I lived there when I was a geology grad student in Alaska.
Wow. Well, and so folks will have to pick up, at least read the excerpt, and then pick up the book to find out why you were above the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, I guess you're implying that I shouldn't tell them, but it wasn't in Alaska this time. It was in Finland, tracking down the roots of a sort of very famous bit of sports medicine that I think your listeners would be interested in.
I think there was reindeer involved too, weren't there?
There not just reindeer, but a reindeer farmer. I was visiting a very special reindeer farmer.
It wasn't Santa Claus. This is not a Christmas story, right?
That's right.
No, and it was and again, we don't want to spoil it for the readers, but certainly I can vouch for the fact that you went to great lengths to get this story and for the whole book, and so it's a fascinating read.
Thanks, I appreciate that. You know, and Tim, and I don't know if you'll allow me to do this, but the, you know, some of what eventually motivated some of my questioning was how sort of ubiquitously famous the 10,000 hours rule had become here.
Yeah.
You know, so this is the idea that 10,000 hours of focused practice is both necessary and sufficient to achieve expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anything that sort of became famous from Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, but the fundamental work actually comes from a study of a small number of violinists by K. Anders Ericsson and colleagues. Sort of, he's known as sort of the father of the 10,000-hour rule. And I have in front of me, when he was on a panel that I helped arrange at ACSM in 2012, so one of the main issues, you know, that I investigated with some of his work was that he didn't report the variance around 10,000 hours for those expert violinists.
You know, it's interesting about that whole argument. I've recently been rereading that, and I don't know if you had caught that Anders Ericsson has published a paper this past month in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, I believe is the name of the journal, because Ross Tucker and Malcolm Campbell did an article last summer, I believe.
Yeah.
And this is a rebuttal to their argument. And, you know, one of the things that he makes very clear, and I think we should make very clear, is, A, that as an individual, Dr. Ericsson is an incredibly nice individual.
Yeah.
And but one of the points he makes is, hey, I didn't say anything about the 10,000-hour rule. He says, if you look at my data, it's like 7,461 hours.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he never used the word rule or anything like that. And you know, I think that's absolutely true. I think it's great that he wrote that article.
Mm-hmm.
because I think it's really important to sort of address the popular portrayal of the work. And one interesting thing he put in his British Journal of Sports Medicine article was he read Outliers for the first time for that article. He attributes the popularity of the phrase 10,000-hour rule to Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, and he says in his paper that he uses the word misconstrued in relation to how it portrayed his conclusions.
Yeah. So let's give our listeners a little bit of the end of the story there, and that is it just practice? If I just go out and practice for 10,000 hours, can I become whatever I want to be, an elite athlete? Or I think there's some guy doing this with golf right now, isn't it?
Yeah, there actually is a guy who quit his sort of day job as a commercial photographer with 0 hours of practice in golf and is now trying to say that with 10,000 hours he'll be a pro. So I guess we'll see. But the answer, look, I think the ultimate, if I had to sum up the book, I'd say there are certain things that I assumed were innate, like the bullet fast reactions of major league hitters,
mm-hmm.
That through my exploration I determined largely are not, and other things, as you well know, that I thought were entirely voluntary, like an athlete's compulsive will to train, that actually might have a large genetic component, and so some skills, I think, as is shown in the book, you can make more progress with than others with practice, but there is no 10,000 hours rule, and I think that's why Anders Ericsson sort of distanced himself from that. So, in fact, elite competitors almost never have attained 10,000 hours of practice by the time they reach the high level, and as you see in the book, there are some rare competitors who reach the world level or even become world champions with 3 digits worth or less of hours of practice.
And that kind of feeds into our American psyche right now, that we all think that we're special, and so that we all have inherent talents that will just make us great at whatever. I mean, I'm thinking of American Idol, of course.
Yeah, and you can see why, because of the incentive there. But I will say, it did make me feel, sort of going through the book, that there were two very prominent examples in the book of people who sort of stumbled on becoming world champions.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I learned about sort of the individualized response to training, the more it did make me feel, hey, if something's not working for you, you should try something else.
Right.
You should look for some other kind of training. And I remember long before I ever knew anything about genetics, and I was in college, I started to realize, hey, this type of training just doesn't work as well for me as the next guy. And this other type, like when I dropped my mileage down and trained more like a sprinter, mm-hmm. my times got better even in my distance events, even in a mile and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it is important to recognize, not everyone's going to run a 205 marathon, but to recognize that each of our genomes are completely unique. And so if we wanted the perfect training, we'd each have a completely unique environment as well.
Yeah, and that comes back to a podcast we did with Claude Bouchard here, where he talked about that huge variability and how people respond to training in a variety of different situations. And that, and I think as scientists, we're all becoming much more appreciative and aware of those kind of variabilities in trainability and just inherent talent.
Yeah, intuitively, I never would have guessed that the variability would be as big as it is when standardized training protocols, but it's in every study. I mean, it's in every single study. We're not talking about 5%, little wiggle room. There are huge differences between people, and that really surprised me how big that is.
Yeah. I've heard you speak before, and one of the questions that always comes up is that if there is some kind of inherent talent, is there a way that we can do genetic testing to tell parents what their kids may be best at?
I mean, at the moment, no. There are some tiny things you could do, right? Like you could get your kid tested for the ACTN3 gene, and if they have at least one of the so-called sprinter variant, then you can say, okay, well, they're not ruled out from being in the Olympic 100-meter final, right? But neither are 6 billion other people in the world. So it only rules out like a billion people. So it's a very nonspecific. It doesn't hold a candle to the quality of information you'd get by taking your kid to the park and having him race the other kids, right? So to me, it's like trying to say what a puzzle with thousands of pieces depicts when you have one puzzle piece. So there's obviously this avant-garde allure of genetic testing for athleticism,
mm-hmm.
and there's some sort of interesting research that shows, elite athletes tend to have more of the so-called correct variants, but it's not consistent. We don't know what most of the genes are. Tons of the studies are underpowered. So I wouldn't recommend anyone at this point getting direct-to-consumer testing for athleticism. That said, some of the sort of, injury, illness, and death genes, I think, should actually, parents and athletes should be more aware of. And the athletic performance gene tests, they should be less aware of. I mean, some of these companies, you know, and it's completely the reverse. People are paying for these athletic performance gene panels. A couple of them, sometimes I can tell where these companies are getting their info from, you know, their studies published on the ACTN3 gene, but sometimes they're throwing in genes that I can't even find any literature behind. They're right. Just like making stuff up.
Right.
So it's sort of frustrating.
Well, that has come up with some of the supposed genes that predispose to concussion or make the concussion injury worse. I know I've seen some of that literature, and that's it's a little bit scary what some of these companies are telling these parents of these kids.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, you're talking about a market that's really sparsely regulated, you know, where the market has moved faster than any attempt to sort of help people understand what genetic information really means. So I think if put in proper context, there are certain sort of risk factors for, like you said, you know, talking about the APOE4 gene, which affects, you know, one's sort of inflammatory response to brain trauma, which does, I think it's repeated over and over in studies, have some effect on how well people recover from brain injury. And if that could be put sort of statistical risk information in proper context, there, I think you're talking about some testing that actually could be useful. But the companies so far have not been so good at kind of helping people understand what they might actually be looking at.
Yeah. Let's put on your forecasting hat. At this point in time, you probably know, if not more than, if not the most of anybody in the world about the genes that regulate performance or where the science is at in that. What do you think is going to happen in 5 years down the road and 10 years down the road in this area?
I think there's going to be more interesting research, but I don't think from like the direct-to-consumer standpoint we're going to be almost anywhere for a number of reasons. One of which is the studies are difficult, right? Like ideally you would want hundreds or thousands of, say, elite sprinters to find out what these sprint genes are. But there aren't really hundreds or thousands of elite sprinters in the world. You know, maybe if you loosen the category, you could say there are hundreds if you loosen the requirements, but there aren't thousands, so that's a problem, because we now know that there's not going to be one sprint gene, right? Most of these genes are going to have tiny effects, which means you're going to need bigger sample sizes to find them, and that's pretty tricky to find for elite athletes. And, you know, there are other reasons. So there are population differences, right? You don't know if, since you're testing one ethnic population versus ethnically matched controls, you don't know if you're finding genes that are applicable to other populations.
Mm-hmm. And that's been the criticism for some of the African studies, right?
Yeah, that's exactly been the criticism where it says, you know, you compare where people have tried to make conclusions about one ethnicity compared to another from a study that only uses one ethnicity and ethnically matched controls. So you can't really make wider conclusions. But you know, and there are also, so when we talked about HCM, the disease that causes sudden death, of those 1,400 mutations, any one of which can cause the disease, 2/3 of them are so-called private mutations, meaning they've been identified in one family. So there you have many different single nucleotide polymorphisms, all that cause the same phenotype, but in different families. So you don't know if the person standing in lane 2 in the Olympic 100-meter final is fast because of the same genes as the person standing in lane 3. So to me, I think, you know, we've sort of, because genetics are so alluring in the technology, we've started to sort of overlook just learning more about physiology and just simple things like body measurement.
Right.
You know, Great Britain did a pretty darn good job of talent search and increasing their medal haul at the Olympics with their tall and talented program, which was basically going into schools and measuring kids they thought were going to be tall and or have long limbs. And they, you know, they had this program called Tall and Talented. The first medal winner of the London Olympics for the home team was Helen Glover, who was just identified as probably going to be tall as a young woman with extremely long limbs. They put her into rowing, which she had never done before. In 2 years, she was on the world circuit. And she was just their first gold medalist. Like, she could hardly, like, stay in the boat when she first started, but they could tell she had this huge, you know, strong cardiovascular system, really long arms proportional to her height, and that's Great Britain's, first gold medalist of the home Olympics. She goes in 2 years from never having tried the sport to the world scene, just from basic sort of body measurements.
Yeah, so does that mean if you're tall and have long limbs, we should all get into rowing?
I think if you should give it a try, and if you have a good cardiovascular system, yeah, that's. I think you can see any time a country gets awarded the Olympics and starts one of these talent search programs.
Yeah.
The same thing happened with Australia. Basically, all they do is try to, the big sports that everyone wants to participate in already have their sort of natural talent sifting, so they don't have to worry about trying that hard. Like, everybody wants to play in the NFL, so we're going to get, for the most part, the best athletes in America trying to be football players. So they'll self-sort. But for the sports where that's not the case, getting the right bodies into those sports makes a massive difference. And that's why you see these talent searches work, where a country will increase its medal haul. So Australia, when they hosted the Olympics, they won 3.03 medals per million citizens compared to 0.33 for the United States.
Wow.
And that was largely the result of finding athletes in certain sports and saying, you know, your body actually fits better in this other sport. And some of those people ended up winning gold medals in sports that they, like, from a skill standpoint, in some cases, were still a little shaky on. The best example was Alyssa Kamplin, who won the aerial skiing gold medal, I think in Turin. And she had been shuffled into aerial skiing as part of Australia's talent search program. She couldn't even ski when she won the gold medal. She fell and crushed her victory flowers on the way down the hill to her press conference for winning the gold medal.
And one of the well-known examples in our country is the move some of our football athletes and some of our track athletes into bobsled.
Oh, yeah, and that's been a huge success, right? I mean, obviously the most famous example of that was with the Jamaican sprinters that led to the movie Cool Running.
Oh, yeah.
Like, here were guys who had never seen snow or ice before, but they were really fast.
Yeah.
And that was enough to get them to the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, Dave, we could talk about this all day. You and I have actually talked about this quite a bit, but we're running out of time here, and so we always like to let our guests have a take-home message. Other than, and I'll say it, buy Dave's book. It's available at Amazon and your local bookstores. And actually, the audio book is up on sites like Audible and so forth, so you can listen to David's melodic voice.
Yeah.
What's your other take-home message?
You know, I would just say I think some of the skills that we think are genetic or innate, if that's sort of code word for innate, are not, and others that we think have no genetic component do. And that's what I learned through the course of this book, and I hope people will really enjoy it. And particularly for people who work in science, I'd be interested to hear, you know, their thoughts about how I portrayed scientists, because I think there are a lot of world champions and elite athletes in this book, but in some ways I think the stars of the book are really scientists.
Yeah. And I'll give you again kudos, because one of the things that you said to us before we started recording was that people find your email online, you will engage with them. You will, if they have questions, they can certainly send you those questions, and you will chat with them about that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm easy to find. I've got a website for the book, and I'm on Twitter. I'm easy to find.
Yeah, super. Well, thanks again, Dave, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And best wishes on the book. We'll be rooting for it here.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you all for taking the time to download us and listen today. And as you know, every week we have this wonderful podcast question of the week. And here with the podcast question of the week is our producer, Cheryl.
What is the leading cause of sudden death in athletes under 35 years old?
Super question. And be the first one to answer that question, and you will win the first T-shirt from our third edition of the podcast T-shirts. We have those. They have just come in. And so we've been telling you this for the last couple months, that the third editions were coming out, and they are really cool. We even have new colors available. So be the first one to answer that question and send us the correct answer at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win that wonderful T-shirt. So again, thank you all for taking the time to be with us. Dave, thanks again for being with us this week.
My pleasure, as always.
And we always appreciate the support, Dave. And again, we hope that you join us next week for our whole new lineup of the fall podcast series, where we always have someone interesting from the world of sports medicine. Until then, we hope that you're active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huff Ines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.